us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And along with my partner, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we host The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can always join us in person or online. Go to naturalnurse.com under schedules and you will see the many classes and workshops that we have available. Since this show is airing as we move into the solstice season and the Thanksgiving season, we have lots to give thanks about. And one of the things I always give thanks about is the fact that I spend the winter in Florida. So that's where I'll be by the next time we have our Natural Nurse and Dr. Z show on, which is wonderful, because you'll hear it nevertheless wherever we are. We can bring you the show. But for those of you who want to come to the clinic and those of you who want an in-person consultation, they will be in Florida for the next few months. And then we'll be picking up again in Oyster Bay, New York. Dr. Eugene Zamperone's clinic remains in Connecticut during the winter months as well. He has a wonderful place at the University of Bridgeport, which is the School of Naturopathic Medicine. It's the only school of naturopathic medicine, fully licensed naturopathic physicians, on this area of the country. The other three, there's two out west, which is National and Bastyr, and then Southwest is in Arizona. And the only other one really is the University of Bridgeport, and they have a wonderful clinic in the School of Naturopathic Medicine, if any of you can get to Bridgeport, Connecticut. So we have so many classes online, which is also exciting. In fact, our online herbal classes are CE certified for nurses, midwives, acupuncturists, nutritionists, social workers, and many other people who have various kinds of certifications. It goes through CE Broker, totally certified. So that's another way that you can get your education. Just go online to naturalnurse.com and click on schedule. And those classes really can be set up at your convenience, besides joining in on some of the regularly scheduled classes. So we love to hear from you at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or naturalnurse.com. Today, we're very happy to have as our guest Richard Montalbaum. Richard has been an avid student of the native flora for over 25 years, and he's been a practicing herbalist since 1997. He blends the use of native medicinal plants with Chinese and Western herbal traditions. He has also studied with David Winston's School of Herbal Therapeutics. David has been our guest on this show many times. And he has also studied with Rosemary Gladstore, who's also been with us here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. She runs Sage Mountain Retreat Center in Vermont. And Richard has studied with many other teachers as well, including New York City herbalist William Vasasiak. He has been a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild and also is on the AHG Council, known as the Board of Directors. And he currently serves as secretary and chair of the AHG Policy Committee and the Committee for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And a very important part of what Richard does, besides seeing clients personally, he teaches classes in clinical herbal medicine, medicine making, field botany, wild edible plants, and mushrooms. And he is also one of the founding partners, as well as the director and a teacher at Arborvitae School of Traditional Herbalism in Manhattan. So thank you so much for joining us today, Richard.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, let's go back in time and share with our audience what originally brought you into your interest about herbal medicine.
Okay, so it's a bit of a long story, but I'll give you the short version. for me, and, you know, I'll say, too, it's very interesting always to ask people that question. So because within herbal medicine in particular, you get such a diversity of answers and responses. So I enjoy asking people that myself. For me, it was actually the plants themselves that first drew me in. I was just growing up in New Jersey and realized at some point that I was had been raised without any awareness of the natural world around me, the birds, the trees, etc. And in particular, the trees and other plants drew me in, and I spent many years basically teaching myself botany and identification of wild plants, and that kind of over a number of years progressed into foraging of wild foods and eventually medicinal uses of plants, and it kind of went from there.
Well, being in that area, I imagine you crossed paths with wild man Steve Brill.
A little bit, yeah. Not so much growing up when I was younger. This is going back to being a teenager, but more recently, certainly, I have, absolutely.
Yeah, he's wonderful at foraging, and also I see you have an interest in mushrooms, and he's a real
expert
as well. Mushrooms. So, you know, it's just so much fun to share that information with others who have similar interests. And so
absolutely.
Then... You know, that's a far cry. It sounds like originally it was an interest, and so that would be something that's a hobby, but it seems like it evolved into a very serious life pursuit for you.
Absolutely, it did. You know, and you're right, it began just being a curious teenager, and I certainly never had an intention of becoming a holistic practitioner that early in my life, and it really was the plants themselves that just led me down that path. And meeting my first, you know, real-life herbalist, quote-unquote, back in the 90s, the kind of mid-90s, living in the Ozarks in Arkansas, and realizing how deep and rich this tradition and this practice is and all that can be done with it.
So when you were living in that area, did you meet traditional healers in the area that people would actually go to rather than seek out a physician for health ailments?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So I was living in a remote part of the Ozarks and mainly working in organic gardens and farms, and and one woman in particular who was a herbalist midwife who I met and saw what she did. And then also just got a chance during that same time to go to one of the big herb conferences of the day, which I highly recommend for everybody to do. They're all around the country at different times, and it's a way to really be exposed to some of the best teachers and herbalists and practitioners that we have. And that really opened my eyes, for instance, meeting David Winston, who you said that you've had on your program, and then quickly realizing that's what I wanted to do, and going back and studying with him. And so he's really my primary and first teacher, someone I'm still close with and do some teaching for at this point as well.
Yes, David is a really interesting, eclectic herbalist who truly brings into the herbal consciousness many different kinds of schools of herbal medicine, which it seems that you do as well, because you talk about integrating some of the more ancient Asian arts, such as traditional Chinese medicine, along with Western herbal traditions.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think there's a lot that can be kind of deconstructed in the whole framework of Western versus non-Western herbalism. I think that it can deceive us a bit as much as inform us, so I try to sometimes avoid those frameworks. But that said, yeah, everything from our native flora, which of course Native American uses are the foundation of, but then as passed through the eclectic medical physicians of the 19th century and into modern times, and scientific data and evidence we have for the use of herbs, but really resting on what I believe is a more reliable foundation, which is thousands of years, if not more, of practitioners' experience. And I do use, as the years go on, I find myself using more and more Chinese traditional frameworks and theory, again, in combination with a Western, you know, biomedical physiological approach, and use that in a wonderful mashup, if you will, that I find works more effectively for quite a lot of people, to have more than one theoretical framework or assessment or diagnostic approach to try to determine what's best for that particular person.
Yes, it does, and it seems that it is also evolving over time. For example, there are so many different schools of teaching in herbalism, as I'm sure you're well aware. There are some very well-respected teachers that feel that you should not use combinations of herbs, but that you should only use simple, such as one herb infused. And for our listeners, that would be a water extraction, something like a tea or a tisane. While many of the older traditions talk about using a complex variety where the different herbs are used for different parts of a formula. Which one do you think holds more weight, or is it sometimes one and sometimes the other in your practice?
Right. So I maybe want to shy away from saying which holds more weight, in the sense that if somebody's doing a good job and working with someone and seeing the result that they need, that's fine. Whatever the theory behind it is almost secondary. But that said, I think that if you look around the world, the majority of traditions practice formulation, and that's what I do as well. So on rare occasions, I might use a simpler approach, but for most people, I'll usually recommend a combination of anywhere from 3 or 4 to 9 or 10 different herbs in a formula. Tends to be the norm that I work with, and a formulation is its own art. You can formulate poorly and formulate well, but I do believe there's a synergy and potentiation that can occur in the efficacy of herbs when combined in a well-reasoned way that really matches the person that you're working with. There are also, within formulations, combinations of herbs that can buffer or mitigate potential adverse effects from other herbs, and what's called in traditional Chinese medicine, for instance, harmonizing the formula. Licorice, for example, is one of the herbs. If you take a look at Chinese traditional formulas, licorice is almost ubiquitous, and one of the reasons for that is not because of the medicinal benefits of licorice itself, which are vast. It's one of the herbs I use quite regularly, but it's considered a traditional harmonizer. It synergizes herbs in a formula and, again, mitigates any kind of potential for adverse effects.
Yeah, and it's also something that's soothing and tastes really sweet, so it overshadows some of the more bitter aspects of some of the herbs in a Chinese formula, so it's perfect to add into the combination. Now, one of the many things I do in teaching herbal medicine as well is I teach botanical pharmacology, and that's often in the setting of a mainstream medical school. And what I find, it's almost rather shocking, is that the one thing most physicians know about licorice root, and they'll be quick to shout out, not that I necessarily agree with them, but I'm wondering what you say when you hear this, and I'm sure you do, that licorice root is dangerous because it raises blood pressure. That's like all they know about it.
Right, that's absolutely true. And it is true that licorice can mildly increase blood pressure, mildly being the key word, and it can also increase fluid retention. So for somebody who already is hypertensive, for somebody who is on hypotensive drugs, for someone who suffers from edema or fluid retention, I tend to avoid licorice. If you look at the data, and this is one of the, which I know you know this, Ellen, but one of the challenges in reaching out to the mainstream medical community is that more often than not, and I hope this doesn't sound too denigrating, more often than not, people do not actually look at the literature. They sort of pass along things they've heard or read rather than really digging into what the data actually tell us. And when you look at licorice, again, I do consider those contraindications. So there are times when I don't use licorice. But on the other hand, used at a normal dose, not overdosing on it, the likelihood that it causes any kind of serious adverse effect along those lines is very, very small. The increase in blood pressure, for instance, again, at a normal recommended dose, is very mild. It's temporary. It goes away when licorice is discontinued. And for anyone with regular or even low blood pressure, it's perfectly fine and safe to use long term. If you look into the case reports of people who have had, say, more acute hypertensive episodes from licorice, it's always an overdose that's involved.
Yeah, and then usually there's a variety of lifestyle influences so that it would be very hard to tease out that it was only the licorice. And the case studies that I read, interestingly enough, were actually about licorice candy. Because in the UK, and it was in the UK, not in America, people often eat these little teeny true licorice root candies. Here in the United States, the licorice candy is usually an artificial flavoring. It's not even extracted from the licorice root. And these people got more or less addicted to it, where they're popping these licorice candies in their mouth all day. Like people, let's say, over-chew a lot of gum, that kind of thing. And those were where several of those case reports came from, where people had been getting some forms of high blood pressure as well as water retention from the overeating of these highly concentrated licorice candies, which was interesting. There's very little data. One or two case studies, which is nothing next to the thousands of people who have used Chinese medicine with licorice as part of it for so many years. And then me personally, and I'm wondering about you personally, and the thousands of patients I've seen in over 35 years of an herbal practice, I've actually never seen it happen. And yet, that's what these physicians think they know about herbal medicine and licorice in particular.
Absolutely. So the downside of herbs, the potential risks and dangers, always gets a lot more press, unfortunately, within conventional medical circles than the positive benefits. And that's unfortunate. But that said, we do have to use herbs safely, and you certainly can misuse them. I have had, over the years, one or two clients who I saw their blood pressure tick up very mildly while taking licorice longer term. And I have then taken them off the licorice at that point. So it is important to be aware that licorice can cause that to happen. But again, it's not anything to be overly concerned about. I think the concern for me is when a holistic practitioner might not be aware of that possibility and isn't looking for that. For instance, if I hadn't been aware of the licorice potentially being the cause of this mild uptick, maybe I would have just started adding on hypotensives or lifestyle choices to reduce blood pressure when really licorice just was an inappropriate herb for that particular person. Again, not resulting in anything dangerous, just giving you that little signal that, hey, this herb is not the right one for this particular person.
That is a great explanation, Richard, because you're so right. Herbs are a wonderful medicine, an ancient medicine, everything from herbs that you can choose for yourself outside to various preparations, good quality ones that you can purchase. But being guided by a knowledgeable herbalist or holistic health practitioner really can be quite important, because sometimes people just, you know, go around taking everything they read about and they really can get in trouble. Just because it's natural does not mean that it's 100% totally safe for any one individual.
I completely agree, and I know this will be a shock for your audience, but not everything on the internet turns out to be true or accurate. So, So, I mean, that said, I will say one thing that I absolutely love and promote and want us to continue fostering about herbal medicine is that there are entry points at all levels, and there are very safe, gentle herbs, so many safe, gentle herbs, that people can begin to just make, prepare them for themselves at home and try out. And it's not as if There's a threshold of years of study before anyone can even begin, but you have to do it smartly and get your information from reliable sources.
So what would be an example of a starter herb if somebody listened today and said, gee, you know what, I really do want to integrate, maybe I want to see Richard Mandelbaum as an herbalist, you know, especially if you're in New York City, but maybe I want to try something myself at home. What do you think a good entry point would be?
Sure. Well, there's so many, and of course it depends what we're using the herbs for. But let's take an example of, say, somebody who, this is very common among people I see, I think New York City life and lifestyle tend to exacerbate this, is the person who's quote-unquote wired and tired, somebody who's adrenally depleted, fatigued, their cortisol levels perhaps are starting to flatline, and they don't sleep well, which of course can be a major contributor to all of that, but is agitated, is not just fatigued, but has a layer on top of that of anxiety, trouble falling asleep. And one of the best herbs for that wired and tired profile, for example, is ashwagandha with Anya somnifera. It comes to us from India, although, and even a lot of herbalists don't realize this, it actually grows throughout the southern Mediterranean and down throughout the majority of the African continent. So there are traditional African uses for the plant too. But most of how we use it comes to us from India and from Ayurveda. And it's a very safe, very gentle herb that is what we call in herbalism an adaptogen. Helps to nourish our endocrine system, reestablish a balanced functioning of the sympathetic and parasympathetic responses, so that if somebody has a overly touchy stress response and as a result of that has become adrenally exhausted over time, and again, trouble sleeping in particular for ashwagandha, the scientific name again is withania somnifera, somnifera meaning bringing on sleep. At a normal dosage, it doesn't make people sleepy or groggy during the day, but I do find it really helpful for that kind of person. And very, very safe. Very rarely is it contraindicated for anyone. There are occasionally, for instance, it belongs to the nightshade family of plants, along with many other plants, and very occasionally if someone has a nightshade sensitivity, they might want to avoid it. But that's the only contraindication I've ever come across for that particular herb.
Yes, very few reports of untoward reaction. Well, we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Today's show, like all of our shows here on Progressive Radio Network, will be posted, which is wonderful because if you're missing it today or if you're hearing it and go, wow, I want to hear what Richard just said again, or I want to tell my friends to listen, all of our shows are archived on Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. Also, to find Richard, you can visit his website at richardmandelbaum.com. And also, there's a link to his school there, the Arba Vitae New York .com school. And the spelling and actually a link to make it easy is right there in the bio under today's show, so you can link right up to it. We're going to take a little break right here, listen to A Natural Medicine Chest, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Mr. Richard Mandelbaum and more about herbs. We'll be right back right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamonic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinnzenolin and cinnzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And when I say visit with us, we can do that in person. We lead lots of tours where we go outside, gather medicinal plants, and make them into your own medicine that you get to take home. We also lead a tour in Chinatown twice a year in the spring and in the fall. And also at navalexpo.com, you can find out when we'll be lecturing there on various topics such as genetically modified organisms, how to use herbs for yourself and your family. And we have many different courses available that you can take any time, day or night, because we offer them online. So check all of that out at naturalnurse.com. Today, we are visiting with herbalist Richard Mandelbaum. He's been an avid student of native flora, as well as having an in-depth understanding of Chinese and Western herbal traditions. He also mentioned Ayurveda, which is the ancient science of various things, including herbal medicine from India. He's a graduate of David Winston's School of Herbal Therapeutics, studied with Rosemary Gladstor, as well as many other fine herbalists, and is himself actively involved in teaching, as well as having classes in clinical herbal medicine, medicine making, and field botany, and offering individual consultations about the use of herbal medicine, and also working with the Arba Vitae School of Traditional Herbalism. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Richard.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Obviously, you have a very big focus on this, and I really enjoyed your explanation of a mild herb that most people can use without having to study for years and years, and that was ashwagandha. That was a beautiful segment about ashwagandha. Now, let's go into an illness that's more severe, and that it's very unfortunate when people get this. I've seen it progress into really basically a life-ruining situation, and I know you have some suggestions, and that is Lyme disease.
Yes, so it's, you know, more and more we're seeing cases increase of Lyme disease. It's spreading from its original, as far as we know, point of origin being Connecticut, New England, and now is common throughout the northeastern United States, the upper Midwest, spreading to other parts of the country, parts of Europe, et cetera. And you know, this is something that I have been working with more and more. My own personal journey with Lyme began with myself contracting Lyme, and this was, goes back about 15 years. But the in more recent times, I would say the last 3 or 4 years, I have just seen this incredible uptick in the number of clients
Richard,
that are coming.
Richard, that's interesting that you said uptick, okay, because that's almost a pun. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
And I happen to know many people, and I've seen this happen within families, where it seems like not everyone can link the fact that they got Lyme disease to a tick, and yet they say that it cannot be transmitted from one person to another.
Well, we're still learning about modes of transmission, it could very well be there are modes of direct transmission that we don't know enough about yet. That said, one thing I will say that's confounding, there are many things that are confounding and mysterious about Lyme. I approach it with humility. I usually advise clients that whether somebody's holistic or conventional, if you are getting too many definitive answers from someone as if they understand everything there is about Lyme, you should walk away. Because in my opinion, we have to acknowledge the fact that we're still learning about it, and it is changing and adapting as well. That said, though, there are other explanations.
We agree. That's right.
Yeah, but there are potential other explanations for what you described. For instance, not everyone notices they've been bitten by a tick. There could be, if there's an infected tick that one member of a family brings into a household, that tick can still be there in the household and potentially infect others. So there are a lot of possibilities. Not everyone notices they've been bitten, and so that shouldn't, there's no one single thing, whether it's blood work, whether it's seeing a bullseye rash, whether it's specific symptoms, that should either rule in or rule out Lyme disease for that matter. You have to put together the whole pattern, and it can be overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed at the same time. I personally believe it's underdiagnosed much more often than overdiagnosed, but by overdiagnosed, I do think there are times when people think that what they're dealing with is Lyme where it might potentially not be. So we have to keep all of these possibilities in mind.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is a case when people ask me, as an herbalist, I would not only rely first and foremost on herbal medicine, because I think there's a place, especially early on, to avoid the development of secondary and tertiary Lyme, which I'm sorry to say I have seen, by the use of conventional medicine as well.
I agree. I think in this case, in particular, if you're in early stages, like you said, 3 to 4 weeks, you know, the standard antibiotic being doxycycline makes very good sense. I believe it's foolhardy to not do that, to be honest, although that can be combined with herbs and other approaches that can potentiate the efficacy of the antibiotics. That said, in later stages, when it becomes disseminated or chronic, I have only seen antibiotics help symptomatically and temporarily, and there's a real downside to the heavy use of antibiotics. So I leave it up, of course, to each client that I'm working with. There's no right or wrong answer in a sense, but I have never seen antibiotics be helpful later on. But early on, absolutely, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's been my exact experience as well. You know, it's something that you really don't want to get. I'm a big proponent, since I know you're walking in the woods quite a bit, since you are an outside forager, as I am. I really support wearing white pants with tight rubber bands around the bottom. I mean, all kind of protective gear, because you really want to avoid this situation as much as possible. But if you do get it, then you need a full medicament together to really make sure that you don't progress to the latest stages. So that's wonderful information.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Prevention is huge, and people should keep in mind, even if somebody currently has Lyme or has had it in the past, you can always contract it again. And so prevention is something I talk in length at length about with my clients. And, you know, a good, thorough, full-body tick check at the end of the day is the most important single thing you can do. There are other things like what type of clothing you wear and natural repellents and that sort of thing, but a full-body check, because those ticks, if they are infected, that's the other thing to keep in mind, is not all deer ticks have Lyme. They have to contract it themselves. That's why a tick bite alone is not enough to tell you. They need to be attached to you for, you know, the numbers will vary depending on what source you seek, but anywhere from 15 to 36 hours, meaning if you, at the end of a day outside, check yourself thoroughly, you're in pretty good shape if you catch a tick at that point. But I do think it's really important to talk about this aspect of Lyme, because one of the things that I'm a big proponent in is the healing and therapeutic value of immersing ourselves in the natural world. And quite understandably, people who contract Lyme are in some cases quite scared to go back out and go hiking and go into the woods. And they're losing that very real therapeutic effect that what in Japan is called forest bathing can have. And that includes the inhalation of aromatic and volatile oils that the plants are emitting into the air in a mature forest. Those have been shown to enhance our production of natural killer cells and other white blood cells, macrophages that help ward off chronic infection like Lyme disease. There are benefits to our blood pressure, blood sugar, et cetera, that I think is actually a vital part of a healing process.
So finding the balance where you could still walk outside. I mean, one of the things I do is I used to really do a lot more bushwhacking, where I'd go right into the forest floor. And now I definitely have changed that and stay more on, you know, pre-assigned paths, more than going right in like I used to in past years before Lyme was around.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although I would say you still want to interact. You don't want to just look. And in fact, one of the things, I recently gave a lecture on the mental and emotional aspects of Lyme, and one of the areas of research that I shared for that, and that I did a lot of spent a lot of time looking into recently, because I find it fascinating, is how much of our microbiome, the bacterial population that shares our body and body space with us, is determined by the environments that we expose ourselves to. And we're learning so much about this, and how much more important, how much there is that's important to that beyond just food and probiotic supplements. And of course, when we're talking about something like Lyme, the more balanced and healthy our bacterial population is, the more that bacteria that potentially can cause a problem can be kept in check. And there are, for instance, many, many bacterial infections, as well as viral and other, that we know can have a profound impact on our mental and emotional state. And I believe that Lyme is clearly one of those. But if we go back and reestablish our healthy populations of symbiotic microbes, and some of that comes from touching the dirt, from touching the plants. You know, we have scientific evidence, what I like to say now, for the benefits of hugging trees. There are microbes like Mycobacterium vaccae, for instance, which is a dirt and mud dwelling bacterium that's been shown to actually enhance our production of serotonin and other neurotransmitters. So the more we distance ourselves from fear or from just cultural separation from the natural world, the more that we put ourselves in a vulnerable position to become ill.
So now, let's say someone does have Lyme. You were already very clear about the fact that certainly the integrative approach might be the best, where you consider using antibiotics, especially in the early stages, to avoid ever getting an advanced disease. So we covered that. But now let's delve into some of the herbal protocols that you have seen successful, perhaps with yourself and others, when they already did have Lyme's disease.
Absolutely. So there are many, many herbs, and again, this goes along with, as I'm sure you practice as well, Ellen, we could talk about dietary approaches and lifestyle approaches, and all of that has to work together and receive equal focus. But in terms of the herbs themselves, one thing I do is I very much individualize the formulations, because Lyme can be more of a neuro-Lyme that targets our nervous system and neurological function. That can be physical as well as mental and emotional impacts. It can be more musculoskeletal, for instance, and more arthritic in its nature. So, for example, I'll mention two of the herbs that are often cited, very popular these days for use in Lyme, Japanese knotweed and teasel root. These can be incredibly helpful, but I use them in a targeted way depending on what patterns and symptomology is occurring in that person. So, for instance, teasel root, which I don't think is a generalized remedy for all cases of Lyme, is very, very helpful when there is a Lyme arthralgia, when there is joint pain and discomfort and inflammation. Japanese knotweed, on the other hand, is excellent for when there is meningeal irritation and inflammation, especially in the back of the neck and the back of the head. It's very common for people with Lyme to get headaches, but there is, and it can vary person to person, but what I see over and over again is a pain and cramping and discomfort at the back of the neck and the back of the head. And Japanese knotweed is very specifically helpful and indicated for that pattern in particular.
Well, thank you for sharing those two herbs. They're so interesting, too. I love the stories about teasel that are discussed in several books on the ancient anthropological use of that plant. For instance, the flower itself was used as a hairbrush. And when you look at it, you can certainly see why. You're talking about the roots, but it's a big, beautiful plant. And that Japanese knotweed, which is so prolific all over the place, I actually like just breaking off the stalks and chewing on them in early spring. And perhaps people know, if they've been spending a lot of money on expensive supplements that are called resveratrol, you will always see Polygonum cuspidatum on the back in the supplement facts box, which is truly Japanese knotweed. So, you know, we see so many uses of these great medicinal components.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The other traditional indication for Japanese knotweed, for instance, is what is known in Chinese medicine as a wind damp pattern. I know we don't have a lot of time to go into Chinese tradition, but these are patterns that I see very commonly with Lyme. Wind patterns, for instance, tend to be patterns that come and go. The severity of the symptoms can change weekly, if not daily. The location of the symptoms, so for instance, people with Lyme arthralgias, they might have an elbow that aches one day, a hip the next, a knee the next, and then a couple of days feeling great, and then a horrible week. And these are all known as wind patterns, and they also manifest emotionally and mentally. I find that people with Lyme often feel irritated, frustrated, angry, and of course anyone with a serious illness, let me say, would feel these things. So that's a piece of the dynamic. But above and beyond what I see with equally serious conditions, there's a Lyme-specific pattern. Many people with Lyme describe their mental state as being almost possessed, feeling like something has kind of hijacked their personality, which in a way it has. And often those symptoms can be equally, if not more, troubling for a person, because if somebody feels like they're losing their mind, they're losing their ability to concentrate or focus, or memory loss can sometimes be severe. Again, emotional state and stability can be compromised. That can be quite scary for somebody, sometimes even more so than the physical symptoms. And there are a lot of herbs that can be helpful for that too. One of my preferred ones for that whole pattern put together is black cohosh. In particular, if the emotional state is more on the depressive side, but black cohosh, which a lot of your listeners might know of popularly as an herb used in menopause, if we go back to the old herbals, we see that the traditional usages for it were mainly for extreme fatigue and aching and cramping of muscles. And that's a combination we often see with Lyme disease. It also has cardiovascular benefits, and Lyme can damage the heart in some cases. It has as well that mood uplifting and elevating action that I described earlier.
Wow, that is great information, Richard. Well, we do have to take one more break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, so our listeners can hear about other shows on Progressive Radio Network. Our guest today is Richard Mandelbaum. That's M-A-N-D-E-L-B-A-U-M. He is right in New York City. You can find him at richardmandelbaum.com or Arbor Vitae School of Traditional Herbalism, and we'll talk more about the school when we get back right after this break. We'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
PRN, 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 Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned.
The story behind the story, your story, my story. It's all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. This is Utrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Null's show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from PRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell this story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, everyone. I'm John Mueller from The Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want to know what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America, tune in twice a week and get it from the horse's mouth, from someone like me who's had boots on the ground down here for over 20 years. Latin America is one of the only places left in the world where you can still live a first world life on a measly Social Security check. And with the first world imploding like it is, everybody needs a plan B. So, tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time and every Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time for The Expat Files, Living in Latin America.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're here today with herbalist Richard Mandelbaum. He has been giving us excellent information about many aspects on a deep understanding of herbal medicine. I particularly enjoyed your discussion, Richard, about the use, which is more of a traditional medical use of black cohosh, because in today's herbal genre, they seem to be trying to pigeonhole herbs, just like with pharmaceuticals, where it's sort of a one drug, one bug approach, like most people would immediately, because of consumer advertising, link black cohosh as a women's herb. But you talked about it in so much of a more expansive way.
Absolutely. And I do use black cohosh quite regularly with women's reproductive issues, including, you know, a challenging or difficult perimenopause or menopause. But, you know, one thing we have to understand is that herbs have, even if we want to reduce it to just a chemical understanding, which I personally do not, but even if we want to stay within that paradigm, we're not talking about a single pharmaceutical constituent locked inside layers of cellulose. We're talking about dozens upon dozens of different phytochemicals that interact and synergize and work in very different ways than isolated chemicals do. So most herbs, except for perhaps some of the strongest ones that have very particular constituents that have very overt actions, the vast majority have multiple uses. And I am a big believer in scientific research when done in an unbiased and thorough way. Unfortunately, there's not enough of that as I would like to see, but there is more and more, and it's an important component of our understanding of herbs. But I actually think that thousands of years of practitioners' experience and usage is incredibly valuable, and nothing is foolproof, but it's also incredibly reliable. You know, the physician Rudolf Weiss, in his book Herbal Medicine, which I highly recommend to everybody, brings up this point, and he writes, empirical data are data. If we have all of this accumulated data of practitioner usage, that actually adds up to something quite important, fairly accurate, and reliable. And so it's important when we're using herbs, like you say, to not pigeonhole those and see St. John's wort as just the antidepressant herb and black cohosh as just the menopause herb. They do so much more. And even within those paradigms, I wouldn't automatically, for instance, use St. John's wort for any kind of depression. You have to get much more specific and figure out which herbs are going to really be best for that person.
So true. Now, we're heading towards the top of the hour, but I don't want to finish the show without you sharing about your project, the Arborvitae School of Traditional Herbalism.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's very exciting. You know, for years and years, people were saying within the herbal community, why doesn't New York City have an herb school? Now, of course, there are a lot of good herbalists in New York City. There always have been. There are also educational opportunities. The acupuncture schools have herb programs, and there are other programs, good ones, at the Open Center and other places. But there isn't a full-fledged school for herbal medicine that gives a multi-year training for practitioners like there are in other parts of the country. And so a colleague, Claudia Keel, and I, she's an herbalist practicing in Manhattan, several years ago decided that it was clear nobody else was going to do it. and really that was the motivation. We decided this, you know, the city needs a good solid herb school. And so we founded Arborvitae, and we have a three-year program in herbalist training that gets increasingly clinical as the 3 years progress. In the third year, there's a supervised student clinic, for instance, and we bring in, we do a fair amount of the teaching ourselves to provide the core education, but we bring in a fair number of guest teachers and lecturers, so our students are exposed to some of the most well-known and respected herbalists in the country as well. And we're still new. We're just in our third year now, But so far, so good, and it's going well. It's all very exciting.
So people can actually visit arbovitae.com. Now, if somebody wanted to come to the school, are there courses they can just take without getting involved in the full three-year program?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking the question. So one thing I'll say just in terms of our location, we're on 14th Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan, and we have a partnership with Tri-State College of Acupuncture, so we share some educational space with them. Yes, very much so. So two things to answer your question. One is that the way we have designed the program is that each year is modular, meaning that students can, although our focus, our priority is students who want to go through the full 3 years and become practitioners, we do have some students who just take the first year, for instance, because they still get a very thorough education. They get close to 400 hours in classroom time on herbal medicine, but maybe they don't want to be practitioners per se. Maybe they just want to have a really solid foundation for themselves, their family, their neighborhood. And so that's one thing that people can take, for instance, a year of the program. But the other is that we offer fairly regularly between the months of September and May community classes. Those usually are Monday evenings, so people can hop on our website, hit the classes tab, and those are drop-in. You know, we ask that people pre-register, but meaning you're just coming to that one evening, 2.5 to 3 hour class. Last night we had Seven Song, who is a well-known herbalist from Ithaca, New York, teach a class on first aid herbs to use when you have no other medical system to support you, for instance. And next week we've got KP Khalsa, who's an Ayurvedic practitioner from Seattle, coming in. So usually 2 to 3, sometimes more per month that we offer.
Well, that's excellent. I want to thank you so much for being our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Listeners, you can always reach us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And Richard, in parting, tell our listeners how they can best find you.
Right. So I have my own website, which is richardmandelbaum.com. And then our school website is arborvitae.ny.com. I believe you said that you're putting the links up for those.
Yes.
And my email address, if folks want to get in touch with me, and phone number is on my website as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And until next time, listeners, we remain wishing you a very, very happy time of giving thanks for all your blessings, as we are doing here at Natural Alternatives. And until next time, we are wishing you the best. Stay healthy.